The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
One of the teachings of Buddhism that has come to be associated with most of the different schools of Buddhism is the teachings of the two truths, that there are two categories of truths that are useful to be aware of. And one of the interesting questions is, how do we know what is true, or how do we know what is real, and or how do we base our life and the meaning of our life on what is true and what is real, as opposed to what is maybe fictitious or imaginary. And so perhaps these idea of the two truths might be interesting for you today. And the two truths, one is could be called fundamental truths, or foundation, maybe a bit better, more than fundamental, maybe foundational truths, and that there are basic truth, and that they form the basis upon which the other truths are built. So foundational truths. And then the second one is designated truths, or conventional truths, truth by convention. So the foundational truths are kind of always true, they're always real in some way, and have nothing to do with convention or designation. And then there's a whole category of things that are built on top of these foundational truths, which has a lot to do with we say it, that's the way it is. So for example, a designated truth would be that the address for IMC is 108 Birch. It's not a foundational truth because the address can be changed. Those of you who've been at IMC long enough know that just two years ago, we were 1205 Hopkins. And we haven't moved. And so that's just a convention that can change quite a bit. And however, the substance of the building, you know, the basic substance of it hasn't changed. It's more foundational too. And based on the substance of the building, we can then, you know, change the names as we wish. And so perhaps in a few more years, we'll decide another address would suit us better. And so it goes. Now, some designations we could designate differently, but it's not very useful to do that because partly these are conventions that help us find our way together as a community. So we could, for example, decide that, no, we don't like the Birch Street address, so we're going to call it, you know, maybe since we're a Buddhist group, we might call it, maybe, why don't we call it Awakening Way. You know, 108 Awakening Way. And that sounds very nice. It's kind of inspiring for those who come. You know, awakening reminds us what we're here for. And but the mail carrier is not going to know where to bring the mail. And people are going to go on Google Maps or whatever, and they're not going to find, you know, Awakening Way. So it's not in that sense, it's not a particularly useful convention if not enough of our society kind of goes along with that convention. So there's some conventions that there's a lot of consent around conventions, and some there's a very local consent. And sometimes the level of consent is just one person, and that sometimes has a lot of trouble. You're the only one who sees it that way. It's interesting that in the time of the Buddha, the Buddha seemingly came up with a kind of fairy tales sometimes, myths or stories that he seemed to make up. And one of them is the origin story, the origin of the universe, of the world. And it's probably best not to think of it that he actually believed this, but it seemed more like he kind of made up the story kind of for pedagogical purposes. And but in the story, he talks about the origins of the first ruler. And he very clearly says that the first ruler was a person who was designated or elected as such by the other people of the time, because there was a need, there was chaos, and so they needed someone to have some order in the chaos. And so they designated someone as the leader, and that was the origin of the first ruler. Now why that's significant in the context of ancient Buddhism, or ancient India, is that there was a tradition of the rulers not being a designation, but being kind of absolute. You know, there's kind of an absolute reality, you know, you're in the lineage of the sun god, for example. Or, you know, your origin comes from your ruler by the or Brahmin, or your caste, for example, was created at the origin of the world, and if that's the way it is, it's a fixed thing, it's absolute, it's not something that can be changed. And the Buddha said, no, it's a designation, these things. And so people live with these designations. And so some of these designations of the that existed at the time of the Buddha, he didn't so much criticize exactly, but some of them he ignored. So, for example, the caste system in India, he ignored it for the purposes of inviting people or having people join the monastic orders or becoming his students. He made no difference to anybody, whether an untouchable or a ruler or a Brahmin or warrior or whatever a caste person might be. And he talks about these things as being designations. We create a tremendous amount of suffering for each other, human beings do, by how we, the conventions we use to describe each other. And we also do a lot of good, the designations, they're all bad, but there can be a lot of suffering when we call people certain things or see them certain ways, like the caste system does. It can cause a lot of suffering. So there's designated truths. Some are useful and some are not. And the designated truths are truths which are built on the foundational ones. And if we have a sense, if we can experience directly the foundational truths, and the idea is to experience them. Some people call foundational truths those things which can be experienced directly, unmediated by a lot of concepts or ideas or conventions. If we can relate directly to or have experience of what's foundational, then it's much easier to see how the conventions are created, how we build these designations, these names and ideas. If you don't see that, then it's sometimes designations are seen as being absolute, or this is the way it is. So there are four of these foundational truths. And the first is what's called the four primary elements, rupa. And these are the four ways in which we kind of, basic ways, major ways in which we have a direct experience of the physical world. So all the different aspects of the physical world, whether it's the internal physical body or the external world out there, is experienced in the ancient kind of language as being belong to either the earth element, the water element, the air element, or the fire element. And sometimes they add the space element as a fifth one. And these elements are not meant to be kind of early physics, but rather supposed to point to ways in which the physical world is experienced. So the earth element, for example, is the way we experience things being hard and soft, or heavy and light. The air element has to do with movement, like the wind. It's a wind element. We feel movement, certainly the wind you can feel, but other things we can actually sometimes feel movement in the body. Nowadays sometimes we call it energy movements through the body. The ancient Indians called it the wind element was moving through, perhaps. And fire element has to do with heat and cold. And the water element has to do with how things are, the cohesive quality. Like when you move your saliva around on your tongue, you can kind of the saliva kind of sticks and kind of is kind of cohesive qualities and just crumble together like powder. So it's not so easy to experience the water element, they say. But all the different things in the body that are kind of, the way things are kind of glued or tied together is called the water element. And they're based on these four elements. There are other elements that come from them. So there's a whole series of minor elements, But these are four primary ways of actually experiencing the world. Now, why this is interesting is that you can actually have a direct experience of smoothness, hardness, heaviness. You can have a direct experience of some of the minor elements, like color is one of the more minor ones. You can see color and shape and things like that, actually experiencing them. And then you can see and watch how the mind is sharp enough, you can see how the mind puts on top of that primary experience a label, a designation of what it is. And that designation might or might not be accurate. So, for example, when I stepped on a long branch at twilight in the jungles of Thailand, it was a branch, 6-foot branch or so, that was sticking out the whole path, the dirt path. It was a branch, it was okay to step on, until it moved. And it was a big snake. And so, well, that was interesting, stepping on a 6-foot snake in the jungle. So sometimes accurate, sometimes not. But also some of these designations are flexible and fluid. So for example, you could have a table that might in one situation be a dining room table, another situation be a writing table. You move it someplace else and maybe it could become a massage table. It could be a place to do an art table. It could be for little kids, it can become the fort. You know, leave my fort alone. And it becomes very important. There can be a lot of arguments about that fort among the kids. And it's somewhat fluid what this piece of wood is. And so when we go into someone's house and see this wooden square thing that feels hard, the mind will evaluate, you know, where it is in the house and how it's being used, and to kind of decide what actually it might be. And so, oh, this is a dining room table. Oh, this is something else. And some things are quite fluid. I have this bell here in front of me, about, you know, a 5-foot diameter bell or something. And I remember once being in downtown San Francisco many years ago and coming across someone who was panhandling, asking for money. And he had a bell just like this, a beautiful Japanese bell that was his begging bowl. And I don't know. I regret that I didn't go back and stop him and ask him. You know what? You know what are you doing with that bell? And it was quite beautiful. It was brass or bronze. It was really beautiful, thick sides, and it's quite something to have. And I thought it was maybe a pity that it was being used for begging, and when it could make a beautiful sound. So sometimes some things are what they are based on how they're used, not what they are in and of themselves. So this bell, again, here at IMC, we designate it as a bell. Most of you would like me to use it as a bell, and that's kind of the convention we have. Most of you would not appreciate it if I used it as a spittoon. But, you know, it would make a very good one. We have another bell over there, so that could be our bell, and this could be Gil's spittoon. And in Asia, among some of the Buddhist teachers that I practiced with there, in fact, they use spittoons during the Dharma talks. You'd hear this gargling. And who says that a Dharma teacher shouldn't spit during a Dharma talk? What?
We should vote on it.
We should vote. There should be consent. A convention. So here, at least here in the West, the convention is that Dharma teachers usually don't spit during a talk. And most of you appreciate that. But these things are quite fluid, you know, they change depending on culture, conditions, many different things. So if you have a sense of how there's a raw experience of a physical object, if the mind can get simple enough, just experience it in and of itself, then you can watch and see how we add all these designations on top. A very interesting one, I think, a fun one is that to point out, is that most of you here today have taken off your shoes. And now, if we all leave here with different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. You know, The shoes don't care. Who cares? Where's the caring? The caring belongs to designation. I remember once, many years ago, when we met in Palo Alto, I had Birkenstocks, and a lot of people had Birkenstocks back then. And periodically, I'd go out to get my Birkenstocks, and there was someone else's there. And so I'd go home with someone else's. And I remember once there was a three-way switch in Birkenstocks. Somehow it happened. And one time that it happened, I ended up with a better pair. And no one ever claimed, no one ever noticed that, mine were kind of ratty. And no one came back and said, where are my shoes? And so as a result, at some point, those newer Birkenstocks, was fair enough to designate them as mine. After a few months or a year of wearing them, they were mine, right? Are they really mine? The idea of my shoes, my things, is that...
That's where they were.
I don't think you want them anymore. And so how fluid are these designations, and do we see them as designations? There's an ancient teaching in Buddhism or analogy of children playing in the sand, making sandcastles all day long, and arguing and fighting about, this is my sandcastle, lean by sandcastle alone, and someone coming along and knocking down one of the kids' sandcastle and being all upset, you ruined my sandcastle. And the end of the day comes along, and they all kind of hold hands and run off together to go home. And then the tide comes in and washes all the sandcastles away. It's mine at a particular time. It's so important then and there. And so it's very fascinating to watch the designation of mine on top of something. All of you coming here today have some degree, maybe not even thinking about it consciously, have designated the place you're sitting as my place. So some of you, if you had to get up and go to the bathroom and you left your cushion on the floor or you left your chair empty and you came back and someone was sitting in your chair on that cushion, you'd feel a little bit off. You'd be like, that was my place. But in an hour, when we all leave here, the fact that this is your chair, next time you come, you won't even remember which was mine. It was somewhere around there I was sitting. How we designate things is very consequential. There's a lot of suffering, a lot of conflict that arises because of it. There's designation. People disagree about what things are. So, for example, in a marriage or in a partnership, if people have fundamentally different understandings of what the agreement is in the partnership, they can miss each other. It can be a lot of conflict. There has to be a shared consent or shared convention about what partnership means. And the partnership is a convention, but it's an important one for that relationship. So how does that get constructed? And what are all the things that feed into that construction of the idea of what a partnership is supposed to be? There's a lot of cultural ideas, a lot of family ideas based on personal experience. It's a very complex thing when two people come together, even in a friendship. And so what do we share? And what do we understand? We don't just see a person walking down the street, and we see an understanding of what it means to be a person, what our relationship to that person is. There's a lot that gets built on. So one of the advantages of mindfulness practice is to let the mind become sharp enough to be able to distinguish between what an experience is in its fundamental aspects versus what the experience is with the addition of the designation we have on top of it. So even as simple as a traffic light, green, orange, green, yellow, and red, right? It doesn't take much mental power, effort, to see the red light, and that means stop. But the stopping, that's a designation. It's not inherent in the color red that we should stop. We've just come to our culture to decide that's what it is. And so It's an activity of mind that's an overlay on top of the redness. And it's possible, if your mind is still enough and quiet enough, it's possible to watch something as subtle as, oh, the red means stop, arise up in the mind, that thought. If the mind is very busy, you don't see it because it's kind of a waste of, you know, time to start referring to everything, seeing everything that way. But it's kind of innocent enough with a traffic light. But how innocent is it with me, myself, and mine? All the designations of this is mine, or other kinds of values that we overlay on top. So the first foundational truth is the physical way we experience physical reality. The second is it's called citta in Sanskrit or Pali, and citta is usually translated into English as consciousness. And for this purposes today, probably that's good enough, the state of the mind. Some people call it awareness. But there's something about the way the mind knows, the quality, overall quality of this knowing mind, which is pretty foundational. You can be aware of knowing, and the sense of clear, pristine knowing of something. And the reference point that I have for this is and some years ago, I loved looking at old photographs. The older, the better. Really old, so the people in the photographs, it had to be people in the photographs, and the people were certainly long dead. And I would love to look, I'd like to look at their faces. In particular, I was drawn to their eyes. And you could see all this expressivity sometimes in eyes from photographs 100 years ago, 120 years ago. And sometimes the photographs are very clear, and you could see this, sometimes you could see a spark of life, of awareness, of an expression of a smile or despair or weariness or something, some moment of life. And I said, look at that photograph and realize that was that person's moment to be conscious. And this is my moment for me to be conscious. And looking at those old photographs and realizing that person's long dead heightened for me the importance or the connection I had to being present and aware here and now. Because it's easy enough for me to not to really feel in some kind of high quality way my presence, my awareness, my consciousness as it occurs in the moment. So it's possible to spend a lot of time thinking about the past. It's possible to think a lot about the future. In fact, the thinking mind or the visioning mind is usually thinking about something. And when we're thinking about something, we're usually concerned about what we're thinking about. And so in a sense, we're kind of looking at the about thing so much that we don't see the knowing, the awareness, the activity itself of thinking or being aware. So I don't know, an example would be that if I'm upset with someone, I'm thinking about that person, and I'm really concerned, very, very concerned about that person, what's right, what's wrong, what has to happen, and I'm pulled into those thoughts. And the idea of me, the feeling, the sense of me being present and aware and kind of open awareness that really clearly knows I am thinking right now can get lost. And there's a huge qualitative difference between being lost in a concern, in a thought, versus stepping back and being able to be clearly aware, oh, I'm thinking about this right now. To be lost in a concern is very easy to get lost in the world of clinging and attachment. And to step back and to realize that there's another whole other side to what's happening. Not only is there what we're thinking about, but there's a subjective experience of thinking, the subjective experience of being aware, of knowing. And Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on the importance of that other half of life, the knowing half, the subjective experience of being present, presence, knowing. Many people overemphasize involvement with their concerns and lose themselves in that process. Being concerned about things is fine, but losing oneself can be problematic. So by looking at these old photographs, it was one of the places where I was reminded, oh, to be conscious, to be aware. Awareness only happens in the living present. If I'm thinking too much about the past, the future, or fantasy, then I'm not in this spark of this moment of being aware and present. And that's one of the foundational truths, this capacity to know and to be aware, to be conscious. And if we're aware of it and in touch with it, then again, it's easy to see how we leave that behind, or how we pick up concerns and issues. And then, even more important, why we do that. Why do we get lost in concerns? Why do we get lost in my resentments, or my fears, or my desires and what I want to see happen? Why do I get pulled this way and that? If you're centered in really feeling strongly that I'm here now, rooted here, then the winds of the mind come through, and you can see them come through. You can see thoughts arise, you can see concerns arise, and you, as you see them arise, you can also then question, what values is my involvement based on? Is it based on, in Buddhist language, greed, hate, and delusion? Is it based on love or generosity and wisdom? Is it based on defending some sense of self, building up some sense of self? Is it based on trying to get something from other people and what's going on around me? Or is it based on trying to be open and present to the situation to discover what's there, to receive what's here in some open, generous way? So a lot of mindfulness practice is pointing back to the benefits of feeling, sensing, being aware. And there's something about being aware or the consciousness which is considered foundational. It's not a designation to be conscious. It's not a convention. The third foundational truth, that, and again, something we can experience directly, is in Buddhism is called cetasikas, which translates as mental factors. And mental factors means all the different activity of the mind that, so for example, if you want something, that wanting is a mental factor. If you put your attention someplace, direct it in a certain place, that directing of attention is a mental factor. If you have equanimity for what's happening, that equanimity is a mental factor. If there's greed, hate, and delusion, it's a mental factor. If there's each of those is a mental factor. And so there's 54 of these mental factors, mental activities, foundational mental activities in the mind that are at the foundation that arise not because of designation or convention. They're not directly tied to more complicated evaluation. Maybe the more primary or primordial, I don't know what to call them, movements of the mind. And these can be known directly as well. And what's interesting in the tradition, there's basically, if I remember right, four classes of these mental factors. There's those mental activities that occur all the time. Some basic idea of attention happens all the time. Energy in the mind happens all the time. Some are particulars, which only occur sometimes. Some are called unskillful. They're not helpful. They cause harm. And then you think that the next one would be the skillful ones. This, because it's that duality or that distinction is used a lot in Buddhism, skillful and unskillful. But rather than calling it skillful, the tradition calls it beautiful. The beautiful states of mind, beautiful activities of mind. Isn't that beautiful? So, in recognition, you know, there's beauty inside of us. And so, compassion is one of those beautiful activities of mind. Sympathetic joy. There's a whole range of them. They say non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion. But usually that's understood, that's the literal translation, but the tradition understands that to be loving-kindness, to be generosity, to be wisdom. Those are activities of the mind. When we can be clearly, strongly aware of the activity of the mind, and at the same time be strongly aware of the knowing faculty, that's when I think the strong sense of presence, the sense of presence becomes quite strong. Presence is kind of a vague thing. What is presence? Kind of, or when all these things, when the idea of being strongly connected to our physical life, our body, the energies, the sensations of our body, aware of knowing faculty itself, aware of the mental functionings of the mind strongly, when all those things are clearly known, then there's a strong sense of presence being here. I think without a strong sense of, with a strong sense of presence comes a clear knowing of what's happening here. And so if we want to be connected to what's to life directly, you want to be connected to these foundational aspects. Now, when we're connected to these foundational aspects, then we build on that to create our more complicated world. Our world of our beliefs, world of our designations and concepts, world of our relationship to other people and other things. And when we start developing these more complicated worlds, personal worlds, that we have to walk through and live and negotiate with, what are the values that we build it on? What provides meaning to this personal world that we're creating and building here? And I think the suggestion here is that when you're clearly aware of what's fundamental, what's foundational, it's a lot easier to understand where meaning and value can come from. So, for example, if you're aware of the mental factors and aware of our body much more closely, it's possible to see what is beautiful and what is unskillful, what brings benefit and what causes harm, and be able to clearly see the beneficial as a beneficial and the harmful as harmful creates a very clear guidance for what is useful and important in this life of ours. Is it useful to pursue a lot of wealth? Is it useful to pursue having a lot of friends on Facebook? Is it useful to pursue having a big, big house or a special car or fancy clothes? Or, you know, there's a lot of things people pursue thinking that their security and happiness can come with those things. But if you're really closely in touch with that foundational aspect of our life, you might see that the pursuing those for the wrong reasons is not going to bring happiness. That happiness resides in this world of our mental factors, mental activity, the activities of our heart. And if we're operating with mental activity that involves greed, hate, and delusion, we're not going to become happy. But if we recognize how we could take responsibility to cultivate and develop the beautiful qualities in our hearts and mind, then we create the conditions for a more reliable happiness. That's much more reliable than the happiness that comes with how much money is in your bank, or what kind of job you have, or what kind of partnership, relationship you have with people. So to begin seeing that, and then as you become aware of the beautiful qualities of the mind, beautiful capacities of the mind, it's not just our mind, but it's also the minds of other people. The potential for these beautiful minds is available for everyone. And so one of the things that can give meaning for our life is how do we live a life that supports this beauty, supports this purity in ourselves and in others? How can we live our life so you go to work and hopefully your job is not just about making money? I think it'd be very unfortunate if all a job is about is making money. But if there's people that you encounter when you work, part of your job is how you are in those connections with people that you have. And are you connecting and operating in such a way that you're supporting happiness, well-being, and beauty, inner beauty, to develop in this community of people that you know? So so that's kind of the, gives a kind of a guideline for meaning and value. So far I've talked about three of these foundational truths. There is the physical experiences of the four elements, there is consciousness, there is mental factors. And the third thing that's foundational, meaning that it can be experienced directly, it's not mediated by concepts and ideas, conventions, is Nibbana, Nirvana. And here we take Nirvana as the experience of release, the experience of freedom. If you clench your fist for a really long time, so it really hurts, and then finally you release your fist, you'll feel relief, you'll feel a release. It's unarguable, you'll feel that. If you keep your mind contracted really tight over some concern, say you're really angry, and the anger gets lifted, you can feel that lifting, that release that happens. If you're really afraid of something, and then the fear lifts, dissolves, you can feel that dissolving of it and the relief that comes. That experience of the release of what is held, grasped, clung to, belongs to this world of Nibbana, of Nirvana. Nirvana is that experience of freedom of release. It can happen in small ways, it can happen in big ways. And that is not something which is convention or designation, but something that being experienced directly. And when you have a visceral, immediate sense of how beneficial and how wonderful it is to have this experience of release, that also then becomes a guide for finding meaning and value in our lives. Not just for ourselves personally, but also to understand what's possible for our community, for others as well, and how we perhaps take care of creating a community, a society, where the possibility of freedom is supported. And then based on these four foundational truths, and having knowing on them, then we start putting together conventions and concepts. So Insight Meditation Center here in Redwood City is just a convention. It's a convention that hopefully supports the cultivation of beautiful states of mind, cultivation of strong mindfulness and awareness, and hopefully a place that cultivates freedom and liberation for people. That's what's really important here. The building, the address, the name of the place. There's a lot of things here that are just conventions that we've kind of, to our best of our abilities, have gathered together and created and agree on because we think it's useful as a way of, for community to come together and explore these foundational possibilities. Some of our conventions we have here are pretty complicated. Like, for example, we have a volunteer director in Hillary. It's just a convention. But it's a convention that we think is very useful. And we have a lot of gratitude for. So how do we hold something when we see it as a convention? It's a very interesting question. And if we understand that the value of the conventions is to support something more important than the conventions, then hopefully we hold the conventions in a different way. If we think the convention itself is the point and the purpose, then it's very easy to end up not only with a lot of suffering, but with a lot of conflict. So hopefully, as mindfulness becomes stronger and understanding of these aspects of life becomes stronger, we become more fluid and relaxed around conventions, about the designated truths. So two truths, foundational truth and designated truth. Both are important, and but if the foundational truth can be the foundation, then the designated truth can do its work the best way it can. If there is no foundation for the designated truth, or we take a designated truth as a foundation, then we're in trouble. So let's return to fundamentals. So, I hope that was okay. A little bit of Buddhist theory of truth. And thank you all very much.